Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Rob Curling. Paul Doyle. Ken Early. Now an illustrious sequence of triumphant Football Weekly stand-ins continues with Norfolk's favourite football and music-loving son, Paul McInnes. Over to you, Paul.
Thank you, James. I feel like I'm starring in a UFC showdown. But no, this is Football Weekly. And coming up, we have the FA Cup. Palace hold Villa and Neil Warnock holds a linesman up against the wall with his teeth. La Liga. Barca are beaten while Ronnie returns with a brace. We'll speak to Dr. Lowe and ask if the brace is orthopaedic. Champions League. It's back, back, back. Oh, and Bex. Previews of the longest ever round of 16 coming up. And we'll even spare a little time for the Football League. Just a little mind. Don't want them getting ideas above their station. This is Football Weekly, Guardian.co.uk. Hello, I am from Norfolk. I am Paul McInnes, formerly of the Music Weekly podcast, until I got sacked in favour of someone better. And in similar positions today, I'm joined by an estimable panel of ponces who know more about football than you know your own parents. On my left, Owen Gibson.
Hello there.
Proper journalist, Owen.
Well, I like to think so.
Do you like to keep your hand in on the less consequential side, just in case you're called up on the podcast?
Indeed, yeah.
Good. Well, over to Mr. Lover, John Ashdown, joins us today. It was Valentine's weekend.
It was, yeah. I was in trouble yesterday because I worked late and hadn't had anything planned. My only gift was a book from a second-hand shop. No cards. Fury, actually, when I got home. I only recovered by a takeaway pizza, which was a last-ditch saving tackle, yeah.
Which often tastes like a second-hand book. And finally, the uncopyable, the inimitable Rob Smythe.
I think you have the wrong person, but hello.
No, Rob, it's great to be here with you today.
It's great to be here with you.
What was your sporting highlight from the weekend, Rob?
Was there one? Probably just marvelling at Tim Lovejoy doing the FA Cup draw on ITV, I think.
Well, this is something we'll hopefully get back into in a minute. When we enter part one, I've never quite understand why this podcast has parts. It doesn't seem to have anything in between them. But part one, here we come, the FA Cup. So, it was the fifth round this week, and perhaps the biggest excitement outside of the draw itself was to be had at Selhurst Park, where Palace twice led Aston Villa before being pulled back for a draw. Gentlemen, feel free to nip in at any point. That was some scorcher by Darren Ambrose.
Oh, it was an incredible goal, wasn't it? Astonishing. I only caught it out of the corner of my eye first time, and it seemed like it was from about 50 yards and flew into the top corner. It didn't look quite so good on the replays. But it was another great result for Palace. I mean, they could easily have held on to the win.
I should have done if it wasn't for some dubious referee.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have this sort of ex-girlfriend relationship with Neil Warnock, not literally, but, you know, as a Sheffield United fan. And I do like to see his lovely smiling face. And, you know, we had 8 years together, and it feels like, but it was the right time to break apart. And, you know, but now I just want him to be happy. And he was happy after that goal. But it also means that when he goes crazy, as he did after the game, like, I don't have to deal with the sort of, I'm not the one there saying, come on, darling, you know, you're making a scene and it's time to go home. Although I just called Neil Warnock darling, which is a slightly worrying turn of events.
I mean, do you think he was right, Owen, in his rant about them?
I could see why I was very angry. Yeah, I mean, it was clearly the wrong decision, wasn't it? But you know, I can also see why he's probably being Neil Warnock has gone perhaps more over the top than he should have done. It's an interesting result, though, isn't it? Because for the club, you know, obviously £400,000 from a replay at Villa is going to be very welcome in the financial straits they're in.
It wasn't an easy decision, was it? Warnock would lose his rag over a throw-in. I mean, the pace at which it came off the keeper, it was clearly a mistake, but I'm not sure. All this stuff about banning the poor assistant referee, I mean, come on.
It was one of those difficult decisions that came at a very important time, didn't it?
Yeah.
And so it looks more...
I completely have sympathy with him because Palace were fantastic, but I don't know. I don't think the assistant referee was badly at fault. It just happened too quickly.
And that pressure was building in that stage in the game, though, as well.
This is the thing with these games. I mean, Palace were wonderful, and there was a really nice primal feel to it, but you just knew, even at 2-1, you knew Villa were going to score. And that's the problem with the FA Cup, really. As you said just before we went on, the disparity is too great now between tiers one and two.
Yeah, I mean, we appear in the pod to be discussing the Villa thing every week, but I wonder, just looking at them yesterday, and particularly looking at Ashley Young, they look knackered to a certain extent. They look leggy.
Well, this comes every year, doesn't it? Because he doesn't rotate and they just collapse like like a something or other.
Like a house of drunks.
Like a wine at closing time. Around March, and every year he buys players, you think, well, he's improving the squad, but every year it just happens, and I can see it going again, really. I mean, this replay is no good to them. Carling Cup on top of the thing for fourth place. I can see them collapsing again, really.
Yeah, well, we'll be coming back to the issue of fourth place later on with an interesting proposal, as reported by even more proper journalist than Owen, David Conn, in today's paper. We'll come back to that probably in part 17 or something, I don't know. Elsewhere in the Cup, quite predictable, was it not? There's only three Championship sides left in the draw, and two of those are there in a replay. Chelsea, Fulham, even Portsmouth swatting aside opponents. Again, the same point I would make about the Southampton-Portsmouth game. I thought Southampton gave a good showing, but ended up tiring at the end. John, did you see that game?
I didn't. I missed it, actually. No,
yeah.
They were the better team, I thought. I did the minute-by-minute, and for 70 minutes, Southampton were great, but you're right, they were shattered, and the counter-attacks were clinical. Yeah. And that's a problem, really, because not only do you have quality telling, now you increasingly have fitness telling in the last third as well.
The way it's played out for the FA is almost the worst, and the ITV, in fact, is almost the worst of all possible worlds, because you've got three of the biggest teams out, and you've also got, you know, a lot of the Championship sides now going out. So you're left with sort of fair to middling Premier League sides plus Chelsea, which is kind of, in terms of trying to market it and trying to, you know, breathe some life into the FA Cup, is the worst of all possible worlds.
I'm sure Clive Tilsey will find a way.
I think it's incredibly tiresome, isn't it? It's not dead, really, honestly. Yeah.
And speaking of Chelsea, I mean, do we think they're clear favourites for this?
Well, watching them on Saturday, again, they played so far within themselves in the first half, and it was 1-1, and, you know, there was an attempt to inject some jeopardy into it, but you just knew that the second half was going to come, and they rolled up, and, you know, got huge favourites.
I'm interested in the quality of team they play, because the others have gone out, certainly Man United and Arsenal, while playing kind of half full teams, half reserve sides. Chelsea still had a lot of big ones, didn't they? Drogba, Ballack, etc. And they've done that. It's not just an Ancelotti policy. It's been the case through Mourinho and Grant. I'm not quite sure why it differs, but it's kind of interesting.
Well, they've also got a squad that's full of seasoned pros. They don't have that many coming through. Although Ancelotti appears to be playing more youth team players than before. Barini's on your bench and whatnot.
Yeah, he's brought sort of three or four through. But again, that's the big question about Chelsea, isn't it? You know, you just feel they've got maybe two more years left in them as that squad, and, you know, very good squad that it is. And then will Abramovich have the will to want to kind of invest in a wholesale restructuring of that squad?
Quick question on Sturridge. He scored at the weekend. That's his second cup goal. How's he look?
Well, he's looked okay in those cup matches, but I think, you know, not quite to do it yet. And it's clear Ancelotti doesn't quite have the faith in him to play in the biggest games or to bring him on in the biggest games. So I think, you know, still questions to be answered.
But yeah, I mean, that's another problem, isn't it? It's like, where do you go in between? Is that you can't risk it in the Premiership to give him a full start, really, apart from maybe when they're at home. So when does he get that chance to develop? Okay, so we got the draw for the quarterfinals, which pairs Chelsea versus Man City or Stoke City, Fulham versus Bolton Wanderers or Spurs, Reading or West Brom versus Crystal Palace or Aston Villa, and Portsmouth versus Birmingham. And of course, the papers are going for this potential three Terry Bridge encounters. Am I the only one in Britain who's completely nonplussed by this? What's the individual? I mean, I see the problem about the captaincy, but what's it matter about Terry and Bridge's relationship, Rob Smythe?
Am I an expert on men's friendships breaking down over words?
Well, yes, and infidelity.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, but they were best friends, weren't they, apparently? Real, you know, BFFs. It's quite an unpleasant thing to do.
Do you think it will make any difference whatsoever on the pitch?
No.
I can't.
It would be funny if Bridge just walked over and slugged him after about 20 seconds, took a red card and then lifted off a shirt saying Team Bridge or something.
It might be what the FA Cup needs.
But the other thing is, they're not going to come into contact, are they? One place centre back, one place left back. I doubt Bridge is going to be marking him on corners somehow. So they're not actually going to come into any contact.
Worst of all, it does give the tabloids an excuse to have another month of this. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, one interesting thing that came out on the blog thread last week was sort of Bridge-related, with the Ashley Cole absence, who plays left back for England. And Bridge obviously appears to be the leading candidate right now. Formica Atomica, pronounce that, made one post. It says, get Parker in the team. Get Scott Parker in the team and pay Gareth Barry at left back. Parker brings more mobility than Barry in the midfield, and Barry is a good crosser of the ball for Heskey stroke Crouch when things don't go well and they inevitably go to the famed Plan B.
I know Barry used to play left back, but that was a long time ago now, isn't it?
John Gregory days.
Yeah, I think Stephen Warnock's the second best left back in the country at the moment, which maybe is not saying much. A lot of people have been talking about Leighton Baines as well as a possible replacement.
Yeah. It's a real shame about Gibbs. I think he's the most natural. In terms of style, he's very similar to Cole. kind of clean inside of attack.
But very young and very untested, yeah. You know, to take to the World Cup.
If it had a strong season with Arsenal and played a good part of it, then I think he might have. But otherwise, yeah, I would probably agree with Warnock, actually.
Mm, and while Baines has had a decent season, he was really shown up in the Cup final last year, and you just wonder whether it's, you know, very top level.
Ashley Cole will be back. He'll play, won't he?
Well, let's hope so. I mean, I think, you know, he has had an awesome season. He's been, you know, as has been well documented, he has been back to his best this year, definitely.
Okay. Now, John, you are the lower league expert. I was supposed to drop in Saints at the end of that discussion so that we could segue seamlessly from one to the other, but hey-ho.
Let me flick over to the championship on the paper.
So it's getting it's going back to as things were at the top of the championship. Just quickly here, we've got Newcastle, but back on top. West Brom getting themselves a little bit of distance from Forest. Any observations beyond the remarkably Latin American hairstyle sported by Andy Carroll up front from Newcastle?
Well, I do think that Newcastle and West Brom are the best two teams in the league. And Forest have just gone off the boil the last couple of weeks, and there has been that sort of slight gap developing. I think an interesting team at the moment are Swansea, who are in fourth, who got a point at... Was it at Newcastle? No, it was at home, against Newcastle. In Swansea. They had a decent season last season, just missed out on the playoffs under Roberto Martinez, who then obviously left to go to Wigan. And that team was very much his team. He was very much the architect of it. He'd been with them for quite a while. He took Yordi Gomez, arguably their best player, and Jason Scotland, definitely their sort of key goal scorer, with him to Wigan. And so you sort of thought, well, that's probably their sort of, you know, that was a real, you know, with him there, they had a real chance. Paulo Sousa came in, who had a sort of an up and down time at QPR. And he's just
Can't blame him for that.
Yeah, well, no. But I mean, he didn't do a sort of, you know, really eye catching job that you thought. I thought when he left QPR, that would be it. You know, he'd go off back to Europe somewhere rather than stay in the Football League. But he's done a wonderful, wonderful job at Swansea. He's kept them in contention. In a way, they're in touching distance with Forest, who are in turn in touching distance with the top two. Although I think Swansea will probably draw a few too many.
And there's apparently, I don't know why I know this, but apparently there's a very interesting league race in League One right now with Paul Lambert's superlative Canaries pulling away at the top.
What a turnaround that's been after the 7-1 humiliation at Colchester.
I think we should have a part 95, which is just all about Norwich City, because we have been amazing. We have been on some phenomenal run. And we turn it round. We were 1-0 down at Brighton. Gus Poyet's Brighton. This is a great thing about seeing all these former, you know, real top-name players now turning up at kind of minor league clubs and managing them for 18 months until they realise they can't hack it. I'm sure Gus has proved himself yet, but they are back in the relegation zone in League One. We turn it round. Late winner from the Dock, Gary Doherty. Convincing header, powering header. And we're now 4 points clear of Leeds.
Who do have two games in hand.
They do have two games in hand.
Yeah, you know, only got a point at Leighton Orient at the weekend. Have come off the boil considerably
one game
with
in
their
six.
FA Cup run. Yeah, and it's competitive up at the top, Charlton aren't far away. So are you sort of a very happy canary at the moment?
I'm a very... this is one of the weird things. I think actually being relegated has been really, really good for us. Not just because we've got Lambert, because we've reshaped the club and, well, we're huge amounts of debts. We've got a plan for the future. But just it's been enjoyable to get on a bandwagon, to see your team going somewhere and doing something.
I mean, it's an interesting, you know, it's true for football fan psychology, isn't it? You know, Newcastle fans say exactly the same. You know, it's been actually enjoyable to go to St James's Park for the first time in probably 4 or 5 years because they've seen winning some games and gaining some momentum and week by week.
And seeing Geordies in the team. You know, we've got young players coming through for the first time in a decade, and that also, you know, makes the supporter bond with the club a little bit more. And I think, you know, we're going to see good season ticket renewal on the back of that, which obviously with the attendances. Well, you look at the FA Cup at the weekend, the attendances, you can see spaces all over the ground. It's good to, you know, where the green shoots appear, it's good to see them. I mean, this is something we're talking about every round in the FA Cup, but the attendances, is this a canary in the mine for high-priced tickets?
I think it's two things happening, really. I think one is that people probably have spent their money on their season tickets and cup tickets tend to be a sort of discretionary spend, so, you know, maybe if it's not as unpredictable as it used to be, as we were discussing earlier, you might think, actually, I'll give it a miss. I think the other thing is, you know, everyone looked on last summer as the real sort of barometer of whether or not people were going to, even in difficult economic times, keep their season tickets going, or whether we'd see a fall off. And we didn't really see a fall off. We saw a fall off in sort of corporate hospitality, but not so much in season ticket sales at the big clubs. But I've got a real feeling that's going to happen this year. And that, you know, as we've seen in other parts of the economy, there's been a bit of a lag between sort of perception and reality, if you like. And people will start to sit down and think, can I really afford upwards of a grand at some Premier League clubs to renew my season ticket?
And so finally on the Football League, John, shall we give a patronising pat on the head to Rochdale?
Oh, well, I always like to give a... I don't know if it's patronising. You know, everybody loves Rochdale for their sort of 37-year story of misery, really, which looks
how
like
old are
it's...
You? How old are you, Rob?
I'm 34, so 3 years to go until
they've been in the,
so you break their record.
They've been in the bottom tier of the Football League, never gone up or down from that tier since 3 years before Rob Smythe was born, as I think many Rochdale fans, you know, take that as the as the measurement. And the, what are they now? 3 points clear at the top of the top of.
Oh, no, they're not wobbling, are they?
Well, they look like they were streaking away. They have got a couple of games in hand, I noticed that looking out the corner of my eye. But the manager down there, Keith Hill, I mean, they were close last season. They made the playoffs, missed out. But, the, you know, they could well break one of those sort of long-term chains.
There's hope for me yet.
Records.
Yeah. We'll see about that come the end of the season. Okay, that brings part one to a close. Bear with us, and we'll be back with part two. A little chat with Dr. Sid in Spain.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Sid Lowe.
Hello.
Hello there, Sid. Here we go. Esta muy nubioso, I order, Dr. Lowe.
Is it?
I think the answer is yes.
Okay. I'm not entirely sure what the question was. But...
Fortunately, I know. It's snowing today in Spain, is it not? You've got winter.
Oh, is that what you were trying to say? I apologize. Yes, it is snowing today, yeah. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get back out this afternoon.
But it didn't stop you the weekend. I hear you went to 5 matches the weekend, 5 out of a possible 10.
Didn't quite go to 5. I watched 3 live in a row on Saturday night, which I was working on, commentated 3 in a row on Saturday night, and then was at both Getafe and Atletico Madrid yesterday. That's 5. It's not 5 out of 10, by the way. I could go one better. It's 5 out of 9, because the Spanish League have now done this thing where they've moved a game to Monday night. So it's 5 out of 9 so far. Tenerife against Mallorca tonight. Am I sad enough to watch it? That's the question.
I think you are. A round of applause, I think, for that. That is a fantastic bout of attendance. And we've got a little post before we get into talking about the league. We've got a little post from the blog. Eckhard, he chimed in. Say hello, Sid Lowe. Since this hello. Saturday, I can hear your commentary on Loyola One TV. Is this new? Do you know about that? It's much better than the Austrian commentary I have heard before. Yours,
well,
Eckhart.
That's one of those free games that I was talking about that I did back-to-back. I must admit, I didn't know about that in so much as I didn't know that I was on Austrian TV. Basically, I'm part of the company in Spain that provides the international feed, so it goes all over the place, but I'm never actually told by anyone where it goes. So it's always a bit of a surprise when someone says they've heard me.
So you're as big as Jörg Haider in Austria. That's really great to hear. So let's talk through.
Which sense am I as big as Jörg Haider?
Well, I mean, I suppose physically you're bigger because you're still alive. Anyway, move on. Let's put this behind us. The big result from the weekend was...
As Jörg Haider would no doubt say.
Very good. Big game, big result. Which was...
Yeah, very, very big. Atletico Madrid beat Barcelona 2-1 at the weekend. It's the first time, obviously, that Barcelona have been beaten this season, 22 weeks into the season. Not only that, it's the first time they've even been behind in a game so far this season, which is pretty extraordinary. And yet there's a sort of sense that this was coming. Everybody was counting on this, and particularly the pro-Real Madrid press was counting on this. They were counting on Atletico to do them a favour, because Atletico traditionally do. Barcelona hadn't won a league game that mattered since the 1st of March last year, and yes, you guessed it, 1st of March last year was away at the Vicente Calderon against Atletico Madrid. This is a side, Atletico now, who I think have lost only one in their last 8 games against Barcelona at the Vicente Calderon, and yet they haven't been able to beat Real Madrid in over a decade. So despite themselves, Atletico Madrid, they've kind of ended up being Real Madrid's best possible allies. And they were very, very impressive yesterday. Traditionally, they've got very good results against Barcelona, and they did it again. But the concerning thing for Barcelona, obviously, as you can imagine, on the face of it, the Catalan press are saying, well, it's just a one game. We were going to lose at some stage, which is something that Pep Guardiola has insisted on all season. He's kept trying to prepare people for this defeat. But it's the way that they lost. It's the fact that they've got lots of players injured, and the fact that they played really, really poorly last night.
And why do you think that is? Is that a running out of steam, or is it just the fact that you can only have these runs that go on so long?
Well, I mean, obviously, on the face of it, that you can only keep a run going for a certain amount of time. You're bound to come unstuck eventually. As I say, the historical side of it is that Atletico Madrid are the team that beat Barcelona. So in that sense, Barcelona shouldn't panic, because the last time they were beaten by Atletico Madrid at the Vicente Calderon, which was last season, they went on and won the league. In fact, the only time of those 8 that they beat Atletico Madrid, they blew the league. So perhaps there's a silver lining there. Also, I think tactically, Without wishing to bore you, I think tactically Atletico Madrid are perfectly suited to Barcelona because of the way they play, rob the ball and break, and Barcelona gave them the chance to do that. But there are more concerning signs, and the first one is a long, long line of injuries now. Five muscular injuries they picked up in 8 days. Seydou Keita was off after 2 minutes last night. Xavi Hernandez was taken off with 10 or 15 minutes to go. And actually, I've just had an email now from Barcelona confirming that he's going to be out for 15 days, a fortnight. So it looks like they're struggling physically. And it's weird, this, because this is off the back of them going out of the Copa del Rey and having 7 days to prepare every match, just when you thought that physically they should get stronger and they should be in a better position. Actually, looks like the very reverse is the case.
So what happens now? Do we start to see some more prodigies coming up from the youth side?
Well, they certainly did that this weekend. They had no right back, so they played Jeffren on the right hand side. It didn't really suit him. He was actually a right sided midfielder converted into that role. We will see some more youth teamers play, I think, over the course of the next few weeks. I think what we'll see more than anything else is Barcelona desperately trying to get people fit in time. And it is something that concerns them, because they're talking about, well, we don't understand this, and these are all muscular injuries. And this does suggest that something is going ever so slightly wrong for Barcelona. And it was suggested to me last night, and it's an interesting idea, and one that I can't actually confirm just yet, but that Barcelona, when they were knocked out of the Copa del Rey, thought, right, this is great, let's take advantage to get the players fit again and do almost a mini pre-season. And it just looks like it might be that Pep Guardiola has pushed them that little bit too hard over the last couple of weeks, and players are breaking down. Bear in mind as well, of course, that two of the players have broken down were at the African Cup of Nations.
Right, so they're being overworked in Spain. Interesting.
It certainly looks that way.
So meanwhile, Real closing the gap on Barca with another couple of goals from CR9.
Yeah, I do wish people would stop calling him CR9. Absolutely mad. A terrible title that is. But yeah, two goals from Cristiano Ronaldo. He came back from a suspension, of course, all that talk about the elbow a couple of weeks ago. He finally came back into the side, scored twice. Importantly as well, both of them assists from Kaká. And there was a feeling, and I must admit, it's a feeling that to some extent I had some sympathy for, that the Real Madrid were playing better creative football, collective football, without Cristiano Ronaldo. And certainly that Kaká looked a little more comfortable. He had more space. He seemed to have a clearer view of the pitch in front of him without Cristiano Ronaldo. But this weekend, those two, to some extent, have put that debate to bed, at least in the short term, with Kaká providing both assists for Ronaldo. Madrid weren't brilliant again, and bear in mind that they won 3-0 away at the team that's bottom of the table and have only won twice all season. So it's nothing to get too excited about. But once again, two goals from Cristiano Ronaldo, and on personal terms at least, he's playing fantastically well.
So tell us about Ronaldo dominating the team when he's in it. Is it similar to the way things work with Manchester United, that the ball had to go through him?
Yeah, almost exactly the same, except that, you know, there's a few caveats to that, which is that Real Madrid have other more creative players, that Real Madrid are not quite so consciously set up to plan the counter-attack as United have been over the last probably 18 months. And I do think that it's problematic, in that one of the things that happens, of course, is that Real Madrid are still in the process with a new coach and a new team, although I suppose 6 months into the season, maybe it's we shouldn't be saying new anymore, of trying to find a footballing identity. And I think when you're trying to get what the Spanish always describe as automatisms into place, you know, the sense of doing things automatically, knowing where people are on the pitch, that can be difficult when you've got a player like Cristiano Ronaldo, who pops up absolutely everywhere, and absolutely everywhere he pops up, he demands the ball. He doesn't just want it, he demands it. He does tend to kind of take passing options off other players, dominate the play. He shoots on sight. I thought he was a little less individualistic at the weekend against Jerez, but again, it was against Jerez. There's no question about his place in the team, but there is just a slight question mark about whether there are certain things that need to be altered ever so slightly.
Is there any sense that, say, Kaká, for example, is unhappy?
No, none whatsoever, and in particular with Cristiano Ronaldo, because they're actually very, very good mates.
Right.
Obviously, you can imagine they both speak Portuguese. They're really quite close to each other. They're both new boys in Madrid. And I think that's significant, because it means that there won't be any clash between them. I mean, obviously, if Kaká had been a player who felt like his game was perhaps suffering with Cristiano Ronaldo, which he may privately feel, and at the same time didn't like Ronaldo, then yeah, maybe we could have a problem. But they do get on very well, so I don't think that's going to be a problem. If anyone speaks out, it won't be Kaká. It would be much more likely, perhaps, to be someone like maybe Karim Benzema or Gonzalo Higuain.
Fascinating stuff, Sid. Just quickly, throwing forward to the Champs League, the return thereof, it's Lyon, Real Madrid this week. Anybody particularly worried about that?
Well, Karim Benzema, because, of course, he's going back to his old club. He's quite excited about it. There was a suggestion in one of the Catalan dailies, and I think this, in a way, tells you everything you need to know about Spanish press. One of the Catalan dailies said, Benzema's bottled it. He's picked up an injury in heavy speech marks. It's obviously not an injury. He's just too scared to go back to Lyon and play in front of his fans. And it turns out today that Real Madrid have declared him fit, and he's absolutely fine. So that story's been knocked on the head. But it is true that Benzema emotionally doesn't seem quite right. So it's big for him, but I must say, it's a slightly disappointing Champions League draw for the Spanish clubs. You look at some of the big games in the competition at this stage anyway, and none of them involve the Spanish clubs. It looks like the kind of round where they should all go through. Obviously, Seville go to Moscow, Barcelona play Stuttgart, and Real Madrid go to Olympic Lyon. And I just think that there's a slight sense of, well, you know, so what?
Part three it is. And you may have already had a slight teaser as to what this is going to be about, because we're going to look ahead to the Champions League. Now, there is a fascinating development today, as reported by proper journalist David Conn, that the Prem themselves, i.e. not Michel Platini, are interested in the prospect of opening up the last Champions League place, the fourth place as is, to a playoff, so that every team in the league from fourth to seventh, that's four teams, will play off against each other at the end of the season, like the Championship playoffs, to decide who gets that valuable Europe place. Now, I know that John's written about this already today. John, very productive. And Owen, this is probably your area of expertise, so we'll start with Rob Smythe. No, of course we won't. Owen, do you think this has got a chance of flying?
I definitely think it has, because obviously the drive for it has come from the 16 teams who aren't part of the Big Four. And so to get anything through the Premier League's structure, you need 14 votes, and so you would think that almost all of those 16 would back this. I just worry it might have a slight law of unintended consequences, in that by lowering the bar to get into the Champions League, you encourage more teams to overreach themselves and reach for that seventh place. And so instead of overspending just to stay in the Premier League, you're now overspending to try and grab the promised land of the Champions League.
Oh, that's a very interesting point, because John, your piece, you were talking about the fact that actually, will it make it less competitive? Well, people would try less hard because it's like, well, why go for fourth when seventh will do?
I think there's an element of that. Yeah. No, I quite like the idea broadly. You know, there are a lot of games towards the end of the season that there's not a great deal riding on. I don't know, Everton against Stoke or something in April. And so it would make sense for the Premier League clubs, for them, if they can sell that as a game that's important for the possibility of getting a Champions League place. I don't know, Owen, is there a big difference between, I don't know if you'd know, between sort of advertising revenue for, say, a Super Sunday on Sky, as towards a bog standard mid-table clash?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, everything goes up. Obviously audiences go up, advertising rates go up, so it would be good for the TV companies, it would be good for the clubs, who'd obviously be able to fill their grounds for those playoff matches. And now that the Europa League is all but meaningless, then obviously it sort of fulfills that job of keeping that tier of, you know, above mid-table, below the bottom four, interesting, doesn't it? And so, I mean, I think you're right, but there's something quite interesting politically going on here as well, because it sort of helps the Premier League's cause to promote this idea that it's the Champions League that's keeping football unequal, and it's the idea it's the top four, the money coming in from Europe, that's enabling them to continue to kind of maintain their hold on those riches, rather than the Premier League, because there's this big debate obviously going on in Europe about, is football unfair, and if so, why?
You know? Yeah, I mean, the one thing about this, if this playoff system does come in, it's not going to address the fundamental issue of how much individual clubs get paid or how much individual players earn in wages, is it?
No, and that's why I think it's got quite a good chance of going through. It enables the top four to retain their hegemony to a large extent, while also allowing those just below them to dream the dream.
To shut up and start whining, yeah. Yeah. Rob Smythe, you had your hand up very politely.
No, I just think it's pretty vulgar, really. I mean, you already have teams who are prioritising finishing fourth over trying to actually win a trophy and get some glory. Now you're going to prioritise finishing seventh over the FA Cup? Well, for a start, it's just a real hoof in the swingers for the FA Cup.
But what is glory, though? I mean, glorious, you know, if you lift a trophy that means nothing to nobody.
Danny Bunch flower, you know, all that.
Yeah, back when the FA Cup mattered.
Exactly, but it only doesn't matter because of the wretched bloody Champions League. And now you're furthering that process by allowing seven teams to compete for it. I agree that the only good thing about it is it will potentially break up the Big Four. But just because you've buggered up once by allowing the Big Four to establish themselves, don't mess it up again to try and compensate for that.
And it's ironic that it's been floated in a year when there actually is a genuine chance of someone other than the Big Four finishing fourth. You know?
Mm. It's difficult because the playoffs have been brilliant in the Football League, but there's something terribly impure about it. You could have a team finishing seventh in a competition called the Champions League.
He's dressed in a red smock. He looks like the Pope over there. There's something dreadfully impure. Can I just... Another thing I picked up from this David Conn piece today is that I didn't realise this, but the Champions League final's being played on a Saturday this year.
That's right. That's another reason why the Premier League have been even more nervous than they previously were about Monsieur Platini and UEFA in the last year or so, because there's a feeling that they're definitely trying to sort of lay claim to larger swathes of the season than they were previously. Obviously, now you've got this round of 16 stretched out over more weeks than previously, and the Champions League final moved to prime time on a Saturday sort of afternoon. So I think there's a real feeling that UEFA are parking their tanks on the Premier League's lawn.
Is anything sacred? Champions League spread over 4 weeks, final on a Saturday, what next? It's getting ridiculous.
Naked football. Everybody naked. I don't know why that popped into my head, but it did. On to the round of this elongated, this enlarged round of 16. We've got United this week, and we've got the return of David Beckham for the first time since he left however many moons ago to Old Trafford. Well, except this leg's in Milan. Rob, how do you see this game playing out? I know United haven't beaten Milan in Champions League competition.
They haven't in four two-leg ties. Milan have won them all. And I think that's almost the main concern, just the weight of history, because Milan aren't much to worry about, really. They have an average age of about 50. The very fact that Beckham is in contention, although he hasn't played the last two games, but the very fact he's in contention shows how average their squad is. I think the gap has closed ever so slightly between Serie A and the Premier League over the last 12 months, but not enough for United or Chelsea next week to be unduly concerned, I don't think.
Does anybody watch Serie A? I know, like, glam people watch La Liga. I kind of been watching a bit of Serie A on ESPN. It's the dullest thing.
It's so really, slow. It's really like boring. Watching 80s football.
Yeah.
It's incredibly pedestrian.
It's like Napoli have got these good players like Quagliarella and Hamzic and stuff, and they're playing in this team that's so restrictive and so stodgy. And they were up against Inter at the weekend, and it's just like two forces of dullness kind of clashing. And lo and behold, the final score's 0-0. I mean, this is Jimbo territory, I won't stay in there, but I couldn't get enthusiastic about any Italian side's prospects for any European competition this year.
No, I think the only thing that's interesting is obviously the Mourinho factor and Beckham with Milan, but you would think maybe eight and a half times out of ten United should beat Milan.
I think the only Italian football I've really watched this season was the Milan derby, and if Milan play anything like they did in that, then they've got very little chance. That said, if Inter play anything like they did, then you know they and that, then that was a sort of swashbuckling performance for the first 40 minutes or so. That the Chelsea game could be a real stonker.
The big concern for United is who plays right back against Ronaldinho, who apparently has been playing very well. You have the choice of Gary Neville, who can't run, Raphael, who is talented but positionally very dodgy, and Wes Brown, who's been like a cart horse all season. So I think that's their main concern. But beyond that, they shouldn't have too many worries. It could be a very slow game because United traditionally go away and play very cautiously in Europe. So I wouldn't advise people to tune in tomorrow, really.
A customarily enthusiastic endorsement there. And we've also got Porto taking on the Arse in Europe this week. Any inklings about that, anybody? Because, I mean, you know, Arsenal, they're supposed to be more relaxed when they play in Europe. It's more suited to their game, but Porto can mix it up a bit.
You would fancy a half-decent team to take Arsenal the form at the moment, but Porto have lost from last season when they were extremely impressive. They've lost Lucho, Lisandro Lopez and the left-back Sissoko. They're only third in the league. They still have Christian Rodriguez, who's a very lively winger, but I'd be surprised if Arsenal fell down there.
It's hugely important for Arsenal, isn't it? I mean, you know, I know they beat Liverpool last week, but after the United and Chelsea results, there's, you know, real rumblings of discontent there again. And, you know, you just feel like there's very thin ice there at the Emirates, and all the sort of anti-Wenger feeling that for all he's done for them, there's an increasing cohort there who say, is his time up? Should he move on? Why is he so stubborn? And you think all that will come back, won't it, if and when they go out, whether it's the round of 16 or quarterfinals? You
know? Yeah, sure. I mean, this goes back to your glory thing again, though, doesn't it? I mean, Arsenal haven't won a trophy for 4 years, and there's that lack of glory. But yeah, he's pursuing this club that grows from within and plays great football.
Yeah, they can kind of compensate for that by taking the moral high ground, which they do, or the aesthetic high ground. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think Arsenal do need to win a trophy. It's kind of weird, though. I mean, the FA Cup doesn't mean that much anymore, and I can understand why Wenger isn't interested in it, but it's still kind of dispiriting.
It would be something on the sideboard, wouldn't it? You know,
and it would stop lazy journalists like us saying it's 5 years.
But it's interesting when it goes going back to the season ticket conversation as well, because, you know, obviously a lot of those not a lot, but a large a percentage of those season tickets at Arsenal are corporate season ticket holders. Are they're largely there because they want to see something won, and it's interesting how those two things play off against one another,
or something entertaining. You know, they want to see that free flowing football, and it doesn't look so good when they're getting.
But it is such an interesting discussion because take the trophy Arsenal last won in the 05 FA Cup final, they were completely outclassed, won on penalties. A year later, they lost very honourably to Barcelona in the Champions League final with 10 men for most of the game. Where do you draw the line? Would they have taken more pride from 05 or 06? Yeah. I don't know.
You've got to ask the individual fans themselves, but they're not the ones who are writing the articles. Final European note, because there is, oddly, perhaps the most bizarre thing of the week, a word for Everton, who restart their Europa League campaign, the meaningless Europa League, as we already observed. They restart it with a 5:45 kick-off against Sporting Lisbon on Tuesday. This is all because Liverpool are playing at home on the Thursday night and police don't want the scheduling. But, I mean, that's the weirdest kick-off time ever. I mean, what next? Saturday, 3 p.m? I mean, you know.
I love the Europa League. I know it gets a bad rep, but, you get a lot of the older, I say older, the sort of, you know, the teams that, you know, you perhaps sort of would see in the 60s and 70s doing really well in European, like your Sporting Lisbons, like Ajax.
Well, slightly good anymore.
Yeah, who basically can't compete with the Premier League and La Liga giants in the Champions League.
Also, there's a hunger and lack of complacency, isn't there? One of the best games I've seen in the last few years was Everton-Fiorentina, when Fiorentina put them out in penalties. Yeah, but the atmosphere was stunning. And another one was Celtic-Spartak Moscow, I think, which was a Champions League qualifier. And again, the atmosphere was just extraordinary. It really was evocative of the past.
Yeah. Even, even Rangers run to the final 2 years ago, although it was very...
Let's not get carried away.
No, but it had its own sort of fascination.
It had its own morbid charm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, of course, Celtic Porto a few years before that.
But against that, you've got to put the fact that it has, you know, really dropped off the map as far as most fans and unfortunately the media are concerned. And, you know, you just wonder when they're going to either put that competition out of its misery or what they come up with next.
Is there just simply far less cash involved in there? Yeah. I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it, I suppose, at the end of the day?
Do you think it will help the reputation of it if a big team like Liverpool win it and kind of Steven Gerrard's waving it to the sky and everything? Will that give it more prestige?
Or would he just be embarrassed and just get it and just kind of walk off?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm not sure it will, because everyone will still consider it a consolation prize, won't they, unfortunately? But I don't think that in itself would...
But Liverpool have a power of their own in terms of making trophies seem significant. Remember the whole five trophies under Julio when one of them was a Sabutia tournament or something?
I think that's a peculiarly biased reading of the situation. one thing you could do is just get rid of the Champions League dropouts. You know, if you want to make it something that's worth something, then it's the people who are lower down the league.
And maybe have a knockout rather than all these
group stages.
But symptomatic of how interesting this topic is, I'm just being told by producer Ben to wind it up. So I think that will bring a line under this Monday edition of Football Weekly Normal. It's been great to be with you. Thanks for listening. Many thanks to Rob, to John, and to Owen. We'll be back on Thursday with an extra. Hope to hear you then.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.